Dead Poets Society has captivated audiences since its publication in 1989, becoming a cultural touchstone that continues to resonate with readers across generations. The novel, based on N.H. Kleinbaum's adaptation of Tom Schulman's Academy Award-winning screenplay, has sold millions of copies worldwide and been translated into over 30 languages. Its exploration of nonconformity, the power of literature, and the tension between tradition and individual expression has made it required reading in countless high schools and universities. Robin Williams' portrayal of John Keating in the film adaptation is considered one of his most iconic performances, with the phrase, "O Captain, my Captain," becoming part of our cultural lexicon. The book's message about seizing the day has inspired countless readers to pursue their passions and question conventional wisdom, making it a perennial favorite among those seeking inspiration to live more authentic lives. The Stone Chapel of Welton Academy stands as an imposing fortress of tradition as the 1959 school year begins, its Gothic architecture and weathered stone walls embodying centuries of educational prestige. Headmaster Gail Nolan, dressed in his formal academic regalia, leads a meticulously choreographed procession featuring ornate banners representing the school's four foundational pillars: tradition, honor, discipline, and excellence. The ceremony, with its ritualistic passing of the light of knowledge from candle to candle, immediately establishes the suffocating weight of expectation pressing down on these young men. Nolan proudly announces the school's impressive statistics, a 75% acceptance rate to Ivy League universities, his words hanging heavy in the air as both promise and threat. Among the sea of perfectly pressed blazers and regimented rows, we meet our central characters, each embodying different responses to the institution's demands. Todd Anderson, a reluctant transfer student, stands awkwardly in his new blazer, perpetually living in his National Merit Scholar brother's shadow. Neil Perry, whose jacket gleams with achievement pins and academic honors, masks a simmering rebellion against his father's rigid expectations. Their circle includes Knox Overstreet, a romantic dreamer despite his privileged background; Charlie Dalton, whose rebellious spirit barely contains itself within his uniform; and Richard Cameron, the embodiment of unquestioning conformity to authority. The annual ceremony requires each student to recite the meaning of one pillar when called upon, a performance they execute with mechanical precision. Their voices echo through the chapel, each word carefully enunciated, demonstrating years of conditioning to respond exactly as expected. The ritual reveals how thoroughly these young men have been trained to sublimate their individual identities into the collective image of Welton excellence. The parting scene between parents and sons unveils the complex emotional dynamics these boys navigate daily. Todd stands isolated while his parents lavish attention on his absent brother's achievements, their dismissal of him speaking volumes. Neil's father, Mr. Perry, methodically adjusts his son's achievement pins without a trace of warmth, treating him more like a project than a child. Dean Nolan moves through the crowd, reminding various legacy students of their family's long association with Welton and the implicit obligation to maintain that legacy. These interactions reveal the emotional austerity pervading these boys' lives, where academic success is not just expected, but demanded. Emotional vulnerability is viewed as weakness, and genuine connection is sacrificed at the altar of achievement. When John Keating is introduced as the new English teacher, his casual demeanor and London experience seem unremarkable within Welton's hallowed halls. Yet beneath his conventional appearance lies a force that will challenge the very foundations this institution holds sacred. His arrival, like a fresh breeze in a stagnant room, plants the first seeds of change in this carefully tended garden of rigid tradition, though none yet recognize the transformation to come. Life at Welton, or Helton as the students call it, revolves around predetermined futures and crushing expectations. Dean Nolan's rounds continue with reminders to Neil Perry that great things are expected of him, reinforced by his father's stern assurance that he won't disappoint us. These aren't hopes, but demands, leaving no room for the boys to discover their own passions or paths. The extracurricular assignments handed out by Nolan reveal how every aspect of the students' lives is controlled. When Todd attempts to request rowing instead of soccer, he becomes paralyzed with anxiety, unable to articulate his preference, a telling sign of how thoroughly the system has already silenced his voice. The roommate dynamic between Neil and Todd immediately establishes their contrasting personalities. Todd has transferred to follow his successful brother Jeffrey's footsteps, already burdened by an impossible standard. The awkward welcome from the friend group emphasizes Todd's outsider status as they immediately recognize his brother's reputation as valedictorian, National Merit Scholar. Mr. Perry's unexpected appearance reveals the suffocating control Neil lives under. The hallway confrontation, where his father hisses, "I will not be disputed in public," and demands unquestioning obedience until Neil finishes medical school, shows the complete lack of agency Neil has in his own life. His quick capitulation with a defeated, "Yes, sir," speaks volumes about years of similar interactions. The argument that follows among the friends exposes their shared frustration with predetermined futures, Knox destined for his father's law firm, Charlie for banking. When Neil angrily rips off his annual achievement pen, it's a small act of rebellion against a future he never chose. The final scene between Neil and Todd reveals the depth of their respective struggles. Todd's family photo showing his peripheral position compared to his celebrated brother and his quiet admission that he'd take Neil's father over his own hints at the emotional neglect he's experienced. Neil's advice that the meek might inherit the earth, but they don't get into Harvard, captures the cruel reality of their world, while his act of stabbing his thumb with the achievement pin until it draws blood symbolizes how these expectations wound them in ways both visible and invisible. The academic onslaught begins immediately at Welton, with each class more demanding than the last. The chemistry teacher, Dr. Hodgkin, overwhelms students with a massive 500-page textbook and assignments requiring hours of nightly study. Latin class with Mr. McAllister promises not just any test, but a comprehensive examination of irregular verbs the very next day, a deliberate strategy to establish dominance through academic pressure. Dr. Hager's trigonometry class operates with military precision, where even a single missed homework assignment results in demerits and Saturday detention. This relentless pressure establishes the academic environment as one of fear and conformity rather than intellectual curiosity, creating an atmosphere where students focus more on survival than learning. Everything changes when the boys enter English class. Mr. Keating's dramatic entrance, sitting silently before suddenly jumping onto his desk and announcing students may call him, "O Captain, my Captain," signals immediately that this class will shatter conventional expectations. His reference to Walt Whitman's poem about Abraham Lincoln establishes both his literary knowledge and his reverence for transformative leadership. The boys' confused expressions and nervous laughter reveal how unprecedented this behavior is within Welton's rigid walls. The first lesson takes place not at desks, but in the honor room, lined with old class photographs dating back to 1859. When Keating has Pitts read Robert Herrick's To the Virgins to Make Much of Time, with its famous line, "Gather ye rosebuds while ye may," he's introducing a radical concept in this environment, that life is fleeting and must be lived fully. The yellowing photographs of young men in identical poses become powerful teaching tools, showing generation after generation of students who once stood where they now stand. His explanation of carpe diem, seize the day, becomes the philosophical cornerstone of the story. By asking students to examine the photographs of former students who didn't wait until it was too late before making their lives into even one iota of what they were capable, he's challenging them to see beyond Welton's narrow definition of success. The boys lean in close to the ancient photographs, studying faces that mirror their own youth and potential. The whispered message from the photographs, carpe diem, seize the day, make your lives extraordinary, plants a seed of rebellion against the conformity the school demands. This first lesson establishes Keating not just as an unorthodox teacher, but as someone offering these boys something they desperately need, permission to imagine different possibilities for their lives. His teaching methods, standing on desks, speaking in whispers, using poetry as a call to action, aren't merely entertaining. They're revolutionary in an environment designed to produce conformity rather than individuality. Through these unconventional approaches, Keating demonstrates that education can be both rigorous and inspiring, challenging the foundation of Welton's traditional teaching philosophy. The discovery of Keating's past involvement with something called the Dead Poets Society ignites the boys' imagination. When they approach him about it, Keating reveals it was a secret group dedicated to sucking the marrow out of life, where members would meet in a cave to read poetry by Shelley, Thoreau, Whitman, and their own verses. His poetic description, "We didn't simply read, we let it drip from our tongues like honey. Women swooned, spirits soared, gods were created," offers these boys something they've never experienced, a vision of passionate engagement with life. Neil's immediate proposal to revive the society reveals his hunger for authentic experience. While Charlie and others eagerly agree, Cameron's worry about demerits and Pitt's concern about grades show how thoroughly the system has conditioned them to prioritize external validation over personal fulfillment. Todd's confession that he doesn't want to read aloud reveals his deep-seated fear of self-expression, while Neil's incredulity, asking how reading could hurt him when the whole point is self-expression, highlights the gulf between their personalities. The nighttime journey to the cave has all the elements of a sacred ritual. After ensuring everyone is asleep, the boys bundle up and meet at the maple tree, sneaking past the school hunting dog. Finding the cave and lighting a fire creates a primal atmosphere far removed from Welton's sterile classrooms. Neil's solemn reconvening of the Welton chapter of the Dead Poets Society, with Todd appointed as minute keeper, establishes a new social order based on shared passion rather than institutional hierarchy. The poetry readings transform the cave into a space of authentic expression. Each selection reveals something about the reader. Knox reads about pursuing dreams while thinking of Chris. Charlie shares humorous verse about drunken love. Cameron delivers O'Shaughnessy's powerful, "We are the music makers and we are the dreamers of dreams." Meeks surprises everyone with Henley's Invictus. Knox dramatically recites Elizabeth Barrett Browning's love sonnet. And Neil reads from Tennyson's Ulysses about striving and not yielding. The climactic reading of the rhythmic Congo poem, with Pitts drumming out its compelling beat, unleashes something primal in the boys. Their wild dancing around the cave and into the forest, making jungle noises, represents a complete release from the constraints of Welton. In this moment, they aren't future doctors, lawyers, or bankers. They're simply young men alive to the power of language and the joy of uninhibited expression. Keating's classroom becomes a laboratory for authentic self-expression. His lesson on language, that it wasn't invented merely to communicate but to woo women, transforms words from academic tools into instruments of passion. By sharing Walt Whitman's ideas about speaking with original energy beyond societal constraints, he's giving his students permission to break free from Welton's stifling conventions. The desk-standing exercise brilliantly illustrates Keating's philosophy. I stand on my desk to remind myself that we must constantly force ourselves to look at things differently, he explains, inviting all students except the reluctant Todd to try it themselves. This physical act of gaining a new perspective becomes a metaphor for the intellectual and emotional journey he's guiding them through. Meanwhile, the boys begin pursuing their individual passions. Pitts and Meeks work on a crystal radio. Knox bikes to Ridgeway High School to secretly watch Chris. And Neil discovers his passion for acting, planning to audition for A Midsummer Night's Dream at Henley Hall. These pursuits represent their first tentative steps toward authentic self-expression. Todd's breakthrough comes through Keating's compassionate but firm challenge. When Todd admits he hasn't prepared a poem, Keating senses his fear that everything inside him is worthless and pushes him to sound his barbaric yap and improvise. Through persistent coaching, Todd creates a powerful, spontaneous poem about a sweaty-toothed madman and truth being like a blanket that always leaves your feet cold. This moment transforms Todd as the class's applause affirms that his voice matters, perhaps for the first time in his life. The contrast between Keating's teaching and Welton's traditional approach comes into sharp focus when Dean Nolan confronts him about his unorthodox methods. Nolan's insistence that tradition and discipline are paramount for boys this age directly contradicts Keating's belief in teaching students to think for themselves. This philosophical clash foreshadows the conflict that will ultimately engulf them all. Keating's warning to Charlie that sucking the marrow out of life doesn't mean choking on the bone reveals his nuanced understanding of freedom. True self-expression isn't about reckless rebellion, but thoughtful authenticity. This wisdom will be tested as the boys navigate the consequences of their newfound voices. Winter descends on Welton Academy, transforming the campus into a stark landscape that mirrors the intensifying emotional struggles of its students. Neil Perry, having discovered his calling in theater, experiences what he describes as being completely alive for the first time in his life. His eyes shine with newfound purpose as he throws himself into rehearsals for A Midsummer Night's Dream, memorizing lines between classes and staying up late to perfect his interpretation of Puck. This transformation stands in marked contrast to Todd Anderson's continued hesitation to fully embrace self-expression, though their friendship deepens when Todd makes the significant gesture of promising to attend the performance, a small but meaningful step out of his comfort zone. The fragile bubble of Neil's theatrical dream shatters when Mr. Perry discovers his son's carefully maintained deception. His father's explosive reaction, demanding immediate withdrawal from the play, regardless of Neil's leading role or the imminent performance, reveals the deep gulf between father and son. Mr. Parry's cold reminder about the financial sacrifices made for Neil's education, "We've made many sacrifices to get you here, and you will not squander that investment," exposes his fundamental view of his son as an asset to be managed rather than an individual to be nurtured. Meanwhile, the Dead Poets Society continues their subtle acts of rebellion, extending beyond their midnight meetings to daily life. They begin eating with their left hands, citing how right-handed conventions perpetuate mechanical living and limit your mind. While seemingly trivial, this conscious rejection of societal norms represents their growing resistance to unquestioned authority and their commitment to living deliberately, a physical manifestation of Keating's teachings about breaking free from conformity. Knox Overstreet's pursuit of Chris takes on new dimensions of boldness, culminating in an audacious gesture that would have been unthinkable months before. Cycling to Ridgeway High, clutching flowers and a carefully crafted poem, Knox demonstrates the transformative power of Keating's carpe diem philosophy. Despite Chris's visible embarrassment and her friend's mockery, Knox interrupts her class to deliver his heartfelt declaration of love, a moment that showcases both his newfound courage and his willingness to risk social humiliation for authentic expression. Neil's decision to lie to Keating about obtaining his father's permission marks a crucial turning point. His inability to meet Keating's searching gaze betrays both his shame at the deception and his desperate determination to grasp this one chance at pursuing his passion. The weight of this choice is visible in his tense shoulders and forced smile, even as he throws himself into final rehearsals. The night of the play becomes the apex of Neil's journey of self-discovery. His portrayal of Puck transcends mere amateur theater. He inhabits the role with natural grace and infectious joy, earning a standing ovation that validates his artistic calling. This triumph turns to ash when he spots his father's stern figure at the back of the auditorium, the moment perfectly encapsulating the collision between his dreams and his prescribed reality. The evening ends in chaos as Mr. Perry forcefully removes Neil from the theater, his shout to Keating to keep away from him echoing through the hall like a death knell for Neil's aspirations. Neil's defeated response to his concerned friends, "It's no use," carries the weight of recognition that his brief taste of freedom and authentic self-expression has come to an end, foreshadowing the tragic decision. The confrontation at the Perry home delivers Mr. Perry's harsh verdict. Neil will be withdrawn from Welton and enrolled in Braden Military School, followed by Harvard and Medical School. Neil's plea that it's 10 more years, a lifetime, falls on deaf ears as his father refuses to let him squander opportunities he never had. This scene exposes the generational tragedy. Mr. Perry's unfulfilled dreams have become chains binding his son. Meanwhile, the Dead Poets Society members gather at the cave to mourn Neil's situation, demonstrating how their bond has grown beyond mere friendship into a community of shared values. Keating's arrival and recitation of Thoreau and E.E. Cummings' Dive for Dreams provide spiritual guidance in this moment of crisis. Todd's volunteering to read marks his complete transformation from the silent, fearful boy we met at the beginning. His original poem, where everyone repeats, "And still we sleep," between verses about dreaming of tomorrow while failing to act today, captures the central theme of the book, the tragedy of lives unlived due to fear or conformity. The juxtaposition of the group's poetry recitation under the frozen waterfall, with Neil sitting alone in his darkened bedroom, creates a powerful contrast between communal joy and isolated despair. As Neil reaches for something inside his father's desk drawer, the continued poetry recitation creates a haunting soundtrack to his final act of desperate self-determination. The gunshot that breaks the silence at the Perry home represents the ultimate price of conformity. Neil's suicide with his father's revolver while wearing his puck crown symbolizes both his final rebellion and the death of his dreams. The devastating news reaches Welton the next morning, leaving Todd and the others in anguished disbelief. Todd's insistence that Neil wouldn't kill himself, blaming Mr. Perry instead, recognizes the true cause of Neil's death, not mental illness, but spiritual suffocation. The investigation that follows reveals the institutional response: find someone to blame rather than examining the system that crushed a young man's spirit. Cameron's betrayal of the group by telling Nolan everything about the Dead Poets Society and blaming Mr. Keating for Neil's death shows how thoroughly he's internalized Welton's values. His suggestion that the others should also cooperate to save themselves reveals his fundamental misunderstanding of what the Dead Poets Society stood for: authenticity over self-preservation. The final chapter brings the themes of conformity, rebellion, and authentic expression to their powerful conclusion. Todd faces intense pressure from Nolan and his parents to sign a document blaming Keating for Neil's death. Despite threats of disciplinary probation and his parents' anger, Todd's refusal to sign and declaration that it's not true demonstrates his complete transformation from the timid boy we met at the beginning. The scene of Mr. Keating returning to collect his belongings while Nolan teaches the class using the Pritchard textbook creates perfect symbolic closure. The institution has reasserted control, returning to the very methodology Keating had rejected as garbage in his first class. Todd's sudden stand on his desk, crying out, "Oh, Captain, my Captain," represents the ultimate act of defiance and tribute. By invoking Whitman's poem about Abraham Lincoln, a leader who died for his principles, Todd acknowledges Keating's profound impact on his life and affirms his commitment to the values Keating taught. One by one, Knox, Meeks, Pitts, and others follow, standing on their desks in silent salute despite Nolan's fury. This visual tableau powerfully illustrates how Keating's teachings have taken root despite the institution's attempts to eradicate them. The boys are no longer passive recipients of education, but active participants in determining what they believe. Keating's emotional thanks before departing acknowledges that while he has lost his position, he has succeeded in his true mission, awakening these young men to the possibility of thinking for themselves. The image of the students standing in defiant homage while Nolan futilely shouts for them to sit down captures the essential conflict between institutional power and individual conscience. The ending suggests that while systems of conformity may appear to win in the short term, the seeds of authentic self-expression, once planted, cannot be entirely uprooted. These boys have glimpsed a different way of being in the world, one where poetry matters, where passion has value, and where the courage to stand for truth outweighs the comfort of conformity. This vision, once seen, cannot be unseen, even as they navigate the consequences of their awakening. In this final act of solidarity, they honor not just their teacher, but the transformation he inspired in them. They have learned the most important lesson of all, that to truly seize the day means having the courage to stand for what you believe, even when, especially when, doing so comes at a cost.